Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021. Today, component costs of capital. I will run this until 4:20, and then I will give you a quiz. It's a five-question quiz, 20 minutes. And you shouldn't have too much difficulty with it, I hope. Now, quick look at the numbers. Market is closed, and as you can see, it was not a pleasant day on Wall Street. The Dow was down 0.75%. The S&P was down 0.5%, and the NASDAQ just barely eked out enough to have 12 cents of increase, which is 0%. So there's that. It wasn't obviously a horrible day, and we had just come off a couple of record-breaking days as far as prices go. The concern was and is that the volume on the exchanges is not strong. Look here at the S&P 500. The total trading on the 500 largest, pretty much largest stocks in the country or the world, as it were, you see that on a typical day over the last year, we had about 3 billion shares trade. Today, we had 2.2 billion, so we're down about 30% on the trading for the day. That is of concern to us. The markets are in a wait and see what happens next kind of situation. There's always going to be talk about a crash happening. Well, we're at a high, so the crash is coming. I mean, I've been around for so long, I don't even take that seriously at all anymore. That doesn't mean that we're not in for a correction. We are due for one, but who knows when it's going to happen. Now, going back over here and having a look, crude oil did shave off a couple of bucks, which is good news. That'll be a little bit of a price decrease. We're starting to see prices actually kind of being ouchy right now, and this will bring a little bit of that off. The cause to what I, to a little bit of background so that you sound sophisticated when you talk about these kinds of things. And trust me, crude oil is a world of its own, and you can be in the business for years and not know, sometimes feel like you don't know anything. But the crude oil, we had a very big supply problem a couple of years ago, a bottleneck, where there was so much oil coming out of the ground, but there were no places for all of that oil to go into ports. It was so bad that what were typically tankers that would transport oil were being converted into tankers to hold the oil. And that was a pretty bizarre situation. Now, in the world of oil transport, you have oil is transported by what are called dirties. Once oil is in a tanker, that's pretty much what that tanker is going to hold forever after that, because unless you've got a whole lot of the detergents to clear out the oil contaminant. So the oil is hauled by dirties. Now, right now, there is has been a lot of oil in the dirties on the high seas, and now it's starting to be able to get into ports where it can be offloaded. Supply going up, price going down. Now, that's not going to last, though. One thing is that there are different classes of dirties. The VLs, the very large tankers, they are just, like, insane, the size of them. The first time I ever saw one of them, I actually thought I was seeing part of a city's dock, the dock at the edge of a city. It was the actual tanker, for heaven's sakes. But these are the very large, and there are not that many ports in the world that can take that oil and offload it and get it to refineries. So those ports, when the oil starts coming in fast and furious, there is a backup. Literally, you'll see it's kind of, if you're into that kind of thing, it's actually kind of a beautiful sight. Late in the late afternoon, early evening, you see this line of these ships with their lights on, strung out back into the Gulf or into the ocean, and then one by one, they're slowly coming in and finding a dock so that they can pump the oil off. Now, the intermediate size, the medium tankers, the medium dirties, they have a lot more ports they can get into, and they have names like the Suez, the Panama, and those ports will accommodate them. They can't take the big ones, but they can take the smaller ones. And so that oil is now starting to get into those ports and getting offloaded and getting into the cracking towers, as they're called. Now, when I say cracking towers, you'll see at refineries these tall, they look like long, thin buildings almost. Those are cracking towers where the hydrocarbons are brought up and at different levels, different parts of it, distillates, gasolines, whatever, are able to precipitate out and get collected. Those refiners are working 24/7 now. They're getting a lot of the oil that's being supplied. And so we've got a nice supply increase. We'll have a price decrease. Once that supply bubble there, that bladder of oil on the high seas gets cleared out, oil's going to go up in price again. When? Probably next month. Gold and silver were up a little bit, nothing to be impressed by. Now, here's an interesting thing. Bonds were down. The yield was down 9 basis points. That's noticeable. That's enough to get my attention. Bond yield going down, that meant prices went up. That means that there was buying of bonds. Well, where was that money coming from? Well, that was sell-off from the equities. You see it? Equities were selling off, and so that money was moving to a little bit safer harbor in the bonds. Bond prices going up, that was causing the yields to go down. I keep saying this over and over again because that's the way to get it to sort of lock in for the rest of your professional lives. Think about these processes and how they are interlinked. Nothing is happening in a vacuum in the business world, especially in finance. Financial Times has tried its best there. The bears smacked it down and bulls came roaring back. But heaven knows those bears weren't finished with it. So about midday, the bears finally had enough and they just beat it down to the ground. Now, interestingly, the Nikkei was down and then it just floated in that lower position. But boy, those bulls just started fighting with it. They're at the last hour and a half, 2 hours, and they got it almost up to flat from where it began the day. So that was a little bit of a roller coaster right there. Now, there was something else I was going to show you here, but I think I'll wait. Okay, enough of that. Cost of capital. Might as well leave it there. Now, as I had showed you before, the weighted average cost of capital is the weight of debt times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity times the cost of equity. Now, of course, the problem there is that the cost of after-tax cost of debt is going to be the pre-tax cost of debt times the yield, 1 minus T. Now, the cost of equity, there is preferred and there is common. Now, in common, there is existing common stockholders and then the new ones that you have to pay more for to get them to join. And we don't have that existing and new with preferred stock or with debt. because they're so cheap, it's so easy to place those. The investment bankers don't charge anything. But boy, when you're talking about new equity, they're going to take, I told you the story last time, we took a massive amount. And in more recent years, the SEC has tightened up how much can be charged. But if you look at the float costs and taking everything into account, you're talking about maybe 8 to 10% in some cases of the price per share doesn't get to the company, which means that the actual real effective cost of the new equity is well above the cost of existing equity. This one, and I've shown this one to you before, you just need to know the tax rate of the company. Now, interestingly, as a brief mention again, and I cannot remember how much I went into it, and I try to avoid having a rant fit about this, but back in the early 1900s, the top marginal tax bracket rate on corporate was 90%. And of course, that would be, by today's standards, just absolutely the most un-American thing on earth. It went down and it stayed at 70% for decades, well into your parents' lifetime. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. I keep forgetting how old I am. God. But 70% was still in play clear to the 1960s. And then the screaming and crying and bawling of the business interests and their lobbyists got it down some more, and it eventually stabilized at a top marginal tax bracket of 39%. Now, interestingly enough, it was, of course, progressive, different levels. Oddly enough, the largest corporations on earth had a top statutory, legal bracket of 35%. It was only the tier below them that had a tax bracket of 39%. And it was always one of those, how is this happening? How does it go to 35 to 39 to 35? And then there was this mumbo jumbo about all these tax issues and unfair taxes of the largest companies on earth. It boiled down to the fact that the largest companies on earth were buying the politicians, Democrats and Republicans both. That's why the biggest companies on earth were paying less at the top than the companies that were somewhat smaller. Whatever, one way or the other. Okay, and it stayed there, that 39% top marginal tax bracket, stayed until there was a movement on it in the first year of the Bush administration in 2001. They claimed that there was a terrible recession happening. And actually, the data did not show that. That was a lie. It was just a bald-faced lie. Even the Federal Reserve altered the data later to make it look like there was a recession. I have the data that was originally in place. But anyway, they enacted the longest, deepest tax cuts in American history to that point. And so we went from budget surpluses to budget deficits. Okay, but we're still at 39%. Then 2017, the top marginal corporate tax rate, that T there, was dropped from 39% to 21%. That is a staggering cut. And that was why we started running insane budget deficits, just insane. We essentially cut off about 40% of the revenue of the government by doing that, 35 to 40% of the revenue of the government doing that. Okay, so now, right now, that T that you would put in there is a 0.21. And that will not last. I mean, well, okay. We're not sure because Congress is pushing to get that back up to where it was. But now the the issue is being framed by the business interests, that this is the worst tax hike in history. Well, actually, it is. Going from 21 to 39% would be the largest tax cut in tax increase in history, except that that was what it was before it was cut. It's kind of an interesting dynamic that's going on in terms of wording and terminology and lack of knowledge of history. But there you are, one way or the other. Anyway, let me go on here. Now, this one is easy to find. You just look at the yield on the bonds of the company. What's the highest yield on the riskiest bond? There's your estimate for R sub D. And then you take 1 minus T and you got after-tax cost of debt. This one is, I mean, the bond yields are in everywhere on the financial charts. You can find those anywhere. Okay, so the pain is when you get over to here. This one is easy. This one is easy because we have this formula for preferred stock. Most companies don't have preferred. Well, I shouldn't say that, but preferred is a very small part of their stack. You see, what I can do is I can say, well, I have this formula that the current price of a share of preferred stock is just the dividend over the discount rate on the preferred. You remember that? Dividends pay the perpetuity, the level perpetuity forever. Well, all I have to do is turn it around and say, okay, R sub P, cross multiply, is just the dividend they pay over the current price. And there's your Uncle Bob. Cost of preferred. That one's not hard at all. Okay. So now we're just kind of cruising along here, living the dream. And then this son of a dog comes along. A little more difficult. Not terrible, but the thing about finding the cost of equity. See, what I'll do is I'll find the cost of existing shareholders. And then it's not hard to do an adjustment for that amount of money that the investment bankers are taking away. It's going to jack it up. If you had a cost of existing equity of, let's say, 16%, you might find that the cost of getting new shareholders of new stock would be maybe somewhere between 16 and 18%, depending upon the float cost. It's enough to get you to notice. And it's, again, one of those things, why would companies ever raise capital through equity if it's so damned expensive? Well, there are a couple of reasons for this I'm going to get into next week, and none of the reasons is good. They're all dark reasons that I've even heard we talk about in corporate circles. Wow, this is why we're doing it. One of those. Let me try this. Let me do something here. You, sir, are a corporate executive, okay? And you're deciding when you're going to sell your stock. We're going to do an IPO. Or no, let's do a seasoned offering. In other words, we have stock out there, and we're going to sell more stock. Now, you've got all the analysis that's been done by your underlings about stock price and projections on it. Would you be more likely to do that stock sale when your price of your stock is very low, or when the price of the stock is near its peak? Yes. You would sell new stock when your stock was at its highest point. I mean, you'd be stupid. Well, we're at the bottom. Let's sell the stock while we're down here at $5 a share. No, you would sell it when you had estimated internally that it had reached its high, because that would get you the most money. That's one of the dark reasons for companies selling stock. They're going to sell it when it's up near its top, not when it's down near its bottom. Anyway. Okay, so we've got this equity thing going on. Before I do much more with that, though, I do want to bring back up the weighted average cost of capital. Say this is 100% debt, and this is your WACC. Now, if you have 0% debt, that would be all equity, so the cost of your firm's capital, the weighted average cost of capital, would just be the cost of equity right there. Right there. That's what it would be. The WACC equation. If weight of debt is zero, then all you've got is 100% times the cost of equity. Now, as you begin to add debt, however, debt is cheaper than equity, so that's going to bring down the weighted average cost of your capital. And that will continue to fall until lenders start saying, this is getting scary. We're lending you, so much of your company is debt that if you have even a fart in sales, you're going to go bankrupt. So at some point, the cost of debt begins to get so strong that it overwhelms the cost of equity, so that by the time you get to 100% debt, you've got a very expensive weighted average cost of capital because it's all debt because you're a 100% leveraged firm. Little background on this. Sounds crazy. Why would a company be 100% debt? It happened. There was a craze with it back in the 1990s. It was the LBO craze, leveraged buyout. Essentially, the company that survived an LBO, a leveraged buyout, was 100%, almost 100% debt. It was a pure debt shell. And of course, that meant it was risky as hell if the revenues even dipped for a little bit below those massive interest expenses, the company was bankrupt. It worked in a few cases, though. God knows how, but it worked. There were companies that were pure debt. They managed to have such strong sales that they were able to pay their interest payments, even though their interest payments were just insane. I mean, the first debt that these companies took, 3, 4% coupon. But by the time you got to a company that's 80% debt, they were still borrowing money, and it was clocking in at 16, 18, 20%. But they kept doing it. They borrowed until it was all debt and no equity. Okay, now, taking that kind of bizarreness aside, remember that the place where the debt-equity combination that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital is called the optimal capital structure. The optimal capital structure. And I mean, it could be 10%. Oh, shut up. I thought I had that shut off. Should have left that in my office. I apologize. Now, it could be 10% debt, 90% equity. In other words, it could bottom out close to there. Could be 90% debt, 10% equity. More often than not, with normal corporations, you see it with more equity than debt, which indicate. I did. What was the company? Was it Amazon or Target? No, I think it was Target. My international delegation, I was showing them the capital structures of American corporations, and I think it was Target. It was about 22.5% debt and 77.5% equity. I think it was Target. It was Target. So anyway, what I'm getting at here is that, now, that's not that unusual. However, there is something odd that is now going on. It's been going on for a few years now. And for better or worse, it has caught the attention of Congress. More progressive sorts. Liberals, progressives, It concerns even the old school of very moderate conservatives along the lines I am, that you see companies, large companies, buying back their stock with debt. That just aggressively. I mean, they're taking, and not only with debt, they're even taking their profits and buying back their stock. Moving their weighted average cost of capital to the right. And the first question is, well, that if they were over here all those years, how come suddenly they're moving that way like their bottom is over there when it was over there just a few years ago? What's going on? The best we can tell is no. The optimal capital structure is not moving. They are simply going this way, moving more toward debt and less toward equity. Why in the hell would they be doing that? What's going on there? Well, it's not that hard to figure out. They're moving toward private status. You see, the problem with being a public company and having public shareholders is that you have to show everything, including your underwear, to the world. You've seen it in the Edgar documents. You say everything. But if you're a private, close company, in other words, you have your small share cluster of inside shareholders and then the rest of your company is debt, then you don't have to show jack to the world. You're not subject to securities laws. You're not subject to a lot of laws that we enforce through the disclosures companies make. You essentially become sovereign corporations, something that was predicted years ago in science fiction, but, you know, that's that. Yeah.
Wait, so in these companies, basically a small group of shareholders is buying, or a small, like, more powerful group of shareholders is buying out the small ones?
No. The company is buying those shareholders out.
Made up of shareholders,
though? Yeah, well, you see, the insiders aren't going to sell. Why would they? They're the ones who will benefit. If everyone else is bought out, then it's their little toy again. You live in a giant condo with all these other people. But here I am, the evil Lord Master. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to simply buy out your leases so that I can keep this for my purposes only. And do you know what my purposes are? To turn it into a cheeseburger factory. No, but you see, yeah, the corporation is doing it, but it is benefiting a small cluster of powerful insiders who will then have control of essentially a small sovereign nation. I don't want to get into conspiracy theories, so I won't, but it is a creepy thing. And it has an obvious reason it's happening, and it has a logical conclusion to what happens when they finished up with this. And yes, some of the largest companies in the United States, and in other words, in the world, are engaged in this right now. Now, the problem is that Congress, in its usual stupidity, says, well, let's just ban it. Well, you can't ban buying stock back. That's a normal practice of companies. You could say, well, there is a limit to how much of a company can be internalized through this process. Maybe that, but how could you say, because these weighted average cost of capital curves are all over the place, so you can't give a one number fits all for anything having to do with this. So the cure might be worse than the disease. Okay, enough of that. So here's what we do. How do we find the cost of equity? It's a pain in the ass. Now, the first one that we would do is what's called the dividend growth model, the DGM. Now, the dividend growth model plays off this little formula right here that we use for finding the price of a stock. P0 equals D1 over R minus G. That was our constant dividend growth model. Now, of course, it requires that the dividend growth be stable. This would work for a mature company. What I do is I say, okay, if P0 equals D1 over R minus G, then I can cross multiply, put the P down as the denominator, R minus G over there, and then there's your Uncle Bob. Cost of equity is D1 over P0 plus growth. Isn't that cool? But this one would work only for more seasoned, mature companies that have stabilized their dividend growth path, etc. If this is the case, notice something important here. Sometimes a formula that is not universally applicable can still give us windows into broader things that are going on. This is true in mathematics, in physics, in quantum physics. Even when we have a hard time solving the hardest problems, the simpler ones or the more limited cases tell us things about the larger process. Look at that. See that R sub E equals D1 over P0 plus G? Something. There are two things in there that would be applicable to any corporation cost of capital. The first is, do you notice that if the growth rate of a corporation increases, its cost of equity goes up? Do you see that? It's a plus G. So if growth rate goes up, the cost of equity goes up. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Boy, this company is growing at a blistering pace. Well, that's great, except that that makes the cost of equity worse. If you have a high fever, I can certainly light the campfire much better with your head. I don't know how the hell I thought of that, but you know. I know, right? I mean, but hey, we've got to cook the bacon some way. Yeah. Good comeback, though. Okay, so that's interesting. Now, here's a much more interesting one. Do you see that the cost of equity is inversely related to the stock price? The cost of equity is inversely related to the stock price? So in other words, if a stock price goes up, if the price of the stock of a company goes up, its cost of equity goes down. And if the cost, if the price of a stock goes down, the cost of equity goes up. I remember the first time I actually had to try to explain this. It didn't work. This was one of those small companies I was consulting for. And I said, well, look, we got a problem. The stock price is dropping. The stock price is going down. And the CEO, president of the company, who wasn't the brightest person, okay, he was a dumbass, but he did have money. He said, well, who cares if the price goes down? We're not selling any stock, so whatever it does, it does. And he didn't understand that this price going down means that the cost of equity is going up. But the company doesn't see that right away. It's like an internal, like a cancer that is eating from the inside out where there are no nerves. The company doesn't feel that stock price going down. Who cares if the shareholders, the stock price is going down? But inside it was hurting the company in a sneaking, hidden sort of way. Ultimately, it comes through and the company can just say, why are we in such bad shape? Well, the stock price was going down. The cost of equity was going up. And so you didn't feel it all those years until it was suddenly overwhelming the company because the opportunity cost of engaging in this enterprise, represented by the weighted average cost of capital, was way too high. And all of your executives have walked away. All of your shareholders have walked away. And here I am sitting here. Why? Because I don't have a ticket back from Houston. So you see that price of the stock matters whether or not the company's selling stock or not. And you think growth rate is great? Yeehaw! We got the furnace fixed. No, you set the building on fire, you fool. Okay, the next way you can do it is the CAPM. You can find the cost of equity just using the capital asset pricing model. We've done it before. We can do it here. Remember the CAPM? You got your beta and you got your expected return. Well, you got your risk-free rate here when there is a beta of 0. And you got your beta of 1. And that gives you the expected return to the market portfolio. So you got a point here and a point here. And so you have your securities market line. You tell me the beta, and I can tell you the return on equity, the cost of equity. Same way we did it before. And, you know, even the same factors. Notice something interesting. If the Fed raises the risk-free rate, but the expected return to the market portfolio stays kind of stable. You notice something odd that happens here? Low-risk companies that had their required return to equity there would actually have their required return to equity go up in that kind of an environment. And companies that were riskier, high-risk companies, that had high return required for equity, they would actually have their required return to equity go down. It's an odd little result. It's an odd little thing. Now, another thing is you can play with this securities market line all kinds of ways. Well, inflation would shift the whole thing up, so everyone's screwed. Or if the expected return to the market portfolio begins to fall, and even though the risk-free rate, you could have this go down to here. You can do all kinds of designs and try different things and see what the results are. Sometimes they are not intuitive at first. You see why eventually. But the bottom line here is that the CAPM gives you a way to do this. Find the beta of the stock. Now, interestingly enough, the problem could come here is that what if the company doesn't have a beta yet? It's too new to have a beta because you have to calculate the beta from market data, and if you don't have the market data, the company doesn't have enough stock returns to see, well, then you've got to do something else. What we do in a case like that is we use what are called comps, C-O-M-P-S, comps, comparables. We say, okay, let's find some companies that are like this company. Then we get their betas and we take an average of them. And this is actually not as hard as you might think. Not that long ago, I needed the beta of a new issue company. And so I went to Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage, and there you can put it in the SIC of a standard industrial classification code for a company and say, find me all the companies with this like this one and give me their betas. Well, in that case, I got like 2,800 betas. I thought there were like 5 or 6 companies doing this. No, there were just several thousand. So it's not hard to get betas of comparables. So that's the way you can do it. And, of course, the risk-free rate, I showed you how to get that from those tables of the treasury yields. Now, the expected return to the market portfolio, as I said, you're just going to have to find one of those services that gives it. Or you could trust yourself. So, for example, what do you say the expected return to the market portfolio is, sir, right now? No, Elon Musk is high. We need a number. Some of you caught that, but
5.6.
5.6? Good grief, okay. Madam, what say you? What's the what over the next year? What do you expect the world portfolio to return?
3.4.
You just guessed, didn't you? Oh yeah, hell yeah. Okay, we're talking numbers like it should be like 8 to 10, 12%. I mean, 3.4. My God. I mean, that's you might as well be invest. Well, you can find a service. Interestingly enough, you guys are kind of ruining the point that I was going to make here, darn you. But what I was going to do was say that if you get a room this size with people who have some education in finance and stock markets, if you take all of their estimates and you take an average of them, you're going to get a damn decent estimate. I mean, probably it will be within a 95% confidence interval of what the actual return to the market will be over the next year. In this case, however, we have troublemakers who think that the market is going to crash. Now, we have more bears than I was expecting here today. Okay, so one way or the other, though, yeah, I mean, this is done. And interestingly enough, the more of your generation of business people go out there, the more the CAPM will be embraced, the more these modern tools, instead of just pulling numbers out of your ass or things like that, which is literally how it used to be done. And it's been a fight over the years. I've even had students from 10, 15 years ago, they got their first job and they said, they're not doing anything like the way you taught us. And I said, that's your job, is you rise through the ranks, you keep your mouth shut, you rise through the ranks, and then when you get to the positions of power, you bring our tools to bear. And so that's happening now, and it's going to happen more with you. Just in time for me to start showing the next generation how wrong we are. Not how wrong, but how old-fashioned we are. But for now, CAPM is definitely the good stuff. Now, the last one that you might have. Well, let me point out the CAPM. JTL Common has a beta of 1.20. The expected return to the market is currently 10.7. That's the expected return to the market. That's the beta of the stock. Okay, so, and the risk-free rate, as proxied by a one-year T-bill, is 1.08%. So there's your R sub F. Now, I want to point this out. Do not be shocked if you see a problem that looks so much like this on the final exam. It looks complicated. You can show your parents, and they'll just be blown away. But look how stupid simple it is. It's just put it into the CAPM. R sub F, 1.08% plus 1.2 beta, 1.20% times, 1.20, I'm sorry, times the quantity, 10.7% minus 1.08%, and you get 12.624. That's all there is to it. That's all there is to it. There's your expected return to the equity. Now the last one. This one is really popular. To get the cost of equity, what you do is you say that R sub E is going to be the risk of debt plus an equity risk premium. And so what you strive to do here is to get that equity risk premium. There are services that do this all the time for different types of companies. Now, there's not just one equity risk premium. There's an equity risk premium for different sizes of companies. There's an equity risk premium that is applicable for the type of industry of the company. So I give you one here. VCJ bonds are yielding 9.66%. You see, almost every company we can find out what the bond yield is. That is easy. That's a transparent process. It's the RCB that's a pain in the ass. So you see, I might not know a lot about you, sir, but I do know what your yield is. You see, you're wearing that mask. I don't recognize any of you. Some of you say hello to me. I don't know who you are. I don't see your. I know your. I see. I say, cover your face like this, and I know who you are now. So the thing, though, is that, you see, a lot of the company is hidden. The R sub E is a hidden thing. But the yield on their debt is right there in front of us. It's in the newspapers. It's, I mean, my God. So all we need to do is know the yield on the debt, which is easy to find. In this case, VCJ bonds yield 9.66%. Then what we do is we look at a cluster of companies similar. We say, okay, their average bond yield is 5.65%. And now these companies, we've had all the data we can get, the risk premium, which the average return on equity is 16.48%. So what that means is that in this industry, the average equity risk premium is their average R sub E minus the part that is just a bond yield. 16.48% minus 5.65% gets us an equity risk premium in this industry of 10.83%. Now I look up here and I say, okay, we've got VCJ bonds yields 9.66%. Okay, so their equity should be a return. Their cost of equity should be 9.66% plus 10.83%. Well, spank me. We've now got to reach their cost of equity, 20.49%. And that, again, that one is really popular because you can pull up things like Standard & Poor's, Bloomberg, and they will give you these equity risk premiums for different industries and different sizes of companies. I mean, you can pull this up. And then whatever company you're looking at, okay, we've got their bond yields. So we just go in here and we add the equity risk premium. We got the cost of equity that easily. And that's pretty nice because then, I mean, if you think these look kind of complicated or something like that, but if you break them down, they're all behind the curtain. They're just pretty simple math and looking up numbers. And so when I do this on an exam, the first thing you don't do is make your back leg go up and down thumping in agony. These are not hard. It's just that you have to know what you're supposed to do. If I give you an equity risk premium, well, that means that we're going to find the equity, the cost of equity, by taking the bond yield and adding that to it. And if I give you a beta, well, that means that we're going to use a CAPM to do it. And in no case, though, is the math really that difficult. Okay, I'm going to have you open up and take your quiz now. When you finish with that, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.